Welcome to the Start Me Up podcast, part of the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network in association with Mother, She Wrote Media. I'm your host, Kimberly Johnson in D.C. Today, I'm going to be talking with White House reporter Brian Karam. But we're not only going to be talking about shop. We're going to be talking about Brian and his personal life, not so much private, but personal stuff. It's going to be fun. I've been watching him online. He endlessly entertains me, and I just have a bunch of questions. So we're going to do that, but before we get into it, the Start Me Up podcast is independent, listener-funded, and woman-run. Visit patreon.com/startmeup to see the variety of tiers offered, including the option to get 2 bonus What's Up episodes per week. Kind of like my online journal where I get a little more personal and talk about whatever is on my mind. There's also an ad-free tier with a much shorter intro. Just visit patreon.com/startmeup. Now please enjoy my conversation with Brian Karam. Welcome back to the show, Brian.
Well, thank you, Kimberly. Thanks for having me.
I've been wanting to have you on for a long time now because I told you on Twitter not too long ago that you're my favorite reporter, and you are. And the reason why is because
I'm my favorite reporter too, but go ahead.
You have such an awesome sense of humor, and it comes out like with your silly pictures, and there's a sense of fun. And like, you know, we see all these journalists all the time and they're serious, and you're a serious journalist, but you're a serious journalist that allows your fun side to come out. And you also play in a band. And so I thought, you know what, I'm going to ask Brian some personal questions so we can get to know him. We all, you know, we know, at least my listeners know, that you wrote a book about the importance of newspapers and journalism and all of that. And I might ask you about that one more time, but aside from the work that you do, I just want a little, you know, I want to know a little bit about you because you just seem so much fun. So we're going to get to some headlines in a minute. But before we do, I first want to ask you about your band and, you know, what kind of music do you play? Where do you play? All that good stuff.
Well, I've been doing stand-up comedy for about 30 years. The band. You want to know about the band. The band is the Rhythm Bandits, and we've been together for about, I don't know, maybe 10 years.
Wow.
I've been in bands off and on since high school. It was the first time I got into a band. In college, I was in a band. I gave it up for a while because, you know, raising kids and, mm-hmm. you know, all that kind of good stuff. I had to give up my motorcycle, too. But then, you know, right before, I don't know, it was during the Obama administration, I think I started going, God, I need to do this. I need to get back into it. And so we, you know, me and a friend of mine got together. I had coached his son in football, and he came over to my house and saw my guitar, and he said, oh, you play? I go, oh, yeah, well, you know, I sing more than I play. But he goes, well, I love to play. I said, let's, you know, put a band together. So we did. And so we've been having fun ever since. We gig out. It's a pub band, so we're at local bars. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've played a couple of concert venues. But mostly it's just about going out. There's nothing more fun mm-hmm. than putting together a group of guys, going out on stage, playing music that people like, and watching people have fun and knowing that you're the reason why they're having mm-hmm. fun. I get no more fun or enjoyment out of life than that. Well, it's like when you do stand-up comedy, it's often the same thing. That's mm-hmm. a little tougher road to hoe. But when you get up and you can make people laugh and make people enjoy themselves and forget for a moment the strife in the world and just live in the moment and enjoy that moment, there really is nothing better than that. And I can't see it any more bluntly than that. It's just a damn lot of fun.
Well, and it looks like you have, I mean, I haven't seen much. I've just seen some of the photographs, and you have one video on your YouTube channel where you're performing. And it totally looks like you're having fun, and it looks like a fun time. So what kind of music are you performing?
Rock and roll, baby. That's from everything. I mean, from Green Day to, Johnny B. Good. I mean, it's just all fun, and it's music that's, you know, and I don't like to do, you know, there's, you know, we'll start out the night with some of the softer music, but I'm not one for ballads much. I would much rather get people up and dancing. Mm-hmm. My goal is for the, you know, we do 3 sets in the night. Well, so it's 3 to 4 hours, and I want you up and dancing for the whole, I am. So, if I can put 3 or 4 hours into dancing, so can you, damn it. So get out and have some freaking fun. Who, I don't want to hear about your bunions. Get up and dance.
Who are some of your favorite bands, rock and roll bands?
Oh, the Beatles. It starts and ends with the Beatles for me. I mean, look, Buddy Holly, because he influenced the Beatles. Chuck Berry. Bo Diddley, you know, the Bo Diddley beat, you know, based on shave and haircut, two bits, dun 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 dun. I mean, that's the only rhythm in and drum rhythm in rock and roll that is named for a person, the Bo Diddley beat. So I love the Bo Diddley beat. I love the Beatles, the Stones, the Who, Led Zeppelin, Green Day, and you know, of course, you can't go anywhere with "Ow, I feel good." So you know, I love all of it. R&B. I'm not a big fan of modern country, or I'm not a big fan of you know, gangster rap. But other than that, I love all genres.
What are you considered Generation X?
I guess I'm the you know, I have that discussion with people all the time. I guess I'm the tail end of the baby boomers, technically.
Okay.
I remember when John Kennedy was, it's one of my earliest memories in my childhood, is I remember when, you know, the day JFK was assassinated. And I remember it because I had never seen my mom cry. And what I remember was being in, you know, I was like, maybe I was just short of 3 years old. And I remember being in the living room with my mom, and we had this little black and white plastic television sat on a brass stand. And you know, it was maybe, you know, I've got computers that are larger than that, you know, TV was now. And we were watching the TV, and I remember Jackie walking off the plane, and it was a black and white TV, and I saw the stain on her dress, and I thought it was chocolate.
Yeah.
And I saw my mom crying, and I said, that woman spilled chocolate on her dress. Aww. And mom crying because she's got a chocolate stain. I better never spill chocolate. And that, you know, that's where my childlike mind was. Yeah. Is I thought that, you know, mom was upset because the woman had spilled chocolate on her dress. Of course, you know, it was Jack's blood.
Right.
She wanted everyone to see it. And so, you know, that moment struck me. And I think that's a dividing line for generations, if you remember that. But, you know, I guess it's the tail end of the boomers is the you know, long answer. But I don't know. I just never identified with any generation. I just identify as me.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty obvious. I mean, you are kind of unique in a good way. So now I want to know, how did you get into journalism?
I wanted to travel the world on somebody else's nickel. I liked writing when I was young. I gravitated toward writing. My family is filled with, you know, my grandfather was a lawyer and an attorney and a judge, a district court, and then a circuit court judge. My grandmother, Karam, his wife was, raised five kids, one of them autistic, and still got her law degree and was a partner with her husband in a law firm, and was one of the very first women to plead a case before the U.S. Supreme Court. I think she was like third or fourth to do it. And wow. My uncles, one of them ended up being back when they had allowed Democrats in the state of Kentucky, he was the Senate Majority Leader. And my other uncle was the Chief Justice of the Circuit Court. So there was a family law firm. And you know, my dad sold cars. And I didn't like any of those, but I liked to write. And the more I got into it, the more I did want to travel the world on someone else's nickel. I wanted a firsthand seat at historic events and to be able to tell people about them. So that led to journalism. And you know, it's been a lot of fun. That, you know, that's why I got into it. It's never paid worth shit, but you know, it's always been a lot of fun to do. And as long as somebody else picks up the tab for my travel, I'm fine.
Oh, wow. I mean, that's fascinating. I actually was interested in journalism for a little while, but eventually I went over to the acting side. So, and it was so funny.
Well, you know, I could have been an actor, but I wound up here.
Yeah, exactly.
Dirty laundry by Don Henley. But you know, I do have one story I'll tell about being a journalist. I was covering a Francis Jones Mills was the treasurer of the state of Kentucky in the mid-80s, and she was on trial for, I can't remember what it was, screwing somebody over money-wise, you know, embezzlement, whatever. And so we're covering the trial, and an AP reporter came to me, and she says, Brian, or, you know, last name, Karam, are you in relation to Peter David or my grandfather, Fred? And I said, yeah, that's my grandfather and my two uncles. And she goes, oh, well, what's your dad do for a living? I said, he sells cars. And she goes, well, wait a minute. Your grandfather was a judge and a lawyer. Your two uncles are lawyers. You're a reporter and your dad's a salesman, a car salesman. I said, yeah. And she goes, couldn't anybody in your family find an honest way to make a living? So, I've always remembered that. It pisses off the lawyers, but it's true.
Well, my mom used to sell cars. In fact, you know, I've got a quick little funny story about that. Is we were living in Southern California at the time, in Torrance, California, which is a beach town. And so she was selling cars, and I think eventually she went up to finance manager. And then there was, I don't remember the details of it, but the long and short was something pissed her off. Eventually, I know that she, I'm getting ahead of myself. Something pissed her off. And she decided she was going to quit. So she couldn't find the person to quit to. And she decided, well, fuck it. So she just quit it over the intercom. She just did it to the whole showroom. I quit. And then I think what wound up happening, and I might get some of this wrong, but at some point I know she was offered to be the manager, of the entire dealership, which was the first for a woman, but she turned it down. So I just thought that was funny. But yeah, she was in the car business too. That's kind of interesting. And were you born and raised on the East Coast?
Louisville, Kentucky.
Oh, that's right.
My dad's childhood friend was Hunter S. Thompson.
Really?
Wow. The very first trophy that Muhammad Ali ever won was the Paul Karam Award in Golden Gloves, awarded to him by my cousin Louis in 1959 or 60. I think my grandfather's law firm both represented at one point in time. Well, helped Danny Thomas, who was a cousin, set up the nonprofit organization that became the St. Jude's, and helped, I believe, Muhammad Ali get out from underneath the ripoff artists in Louisville. And if you listen to my uncle Joe, he was the one that got Hunter Thompson out of he had been accused of robbing a gas station or something, and Uncle Joe got him out of that and into the Air Force, so he would later become a reporter. Louisville, Kentucky was filled with a lot of characters.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, it was your journalism that brought you here, right, to D.C.?
Yeah, I was working for a television show called America's Most Wanted. That's what brought me here.
Interesting. What were you doing on that show?
I was the investigative reporter. And that's why if you ask me if I know of a city and I say yes, if it's a city in the United States and I say yes, I know it, then usually that means I have covered a horrible crime in that area and can tell you about, you know, a triple murder or something like that. Like in Torrance, California, I covered a double murder, and that's how I know where that was. It was a guy who killed his wife, I think, and his daughter, and then went on an 8-state crime spree. They always go on an 8-state crime spree.
I don't know why.
No more,
laughing.
No less. It's 8 states. So that's so I was I covered the Branch Davidians. I covered my first time in the White House was in during the Reagan administration, when I was doing a piece on, I had been down in Laredo and covered the border extensively, and when I went back to I got a job at WKYT TV in Lexington as their Capitol Bureau reporters. So I was covering the State House, and I covered Mitch McConnell way back when.
Wow.
So I had, one of the things that we did was a story on illegal immigrants coming to Kentucky as part of the horse circuit. And to do that, the Simpson-Mazzoli bill at that point in time was up for grabs and sponsored by Romano Mazzoli from Louisville. And that was to make it, until that point in time, it may have been illegal to be in the United States without, you know, documentation, but it wasn't illegal to hire illegal immigrants. Hmm. And so this, and by the way, no one's ever really been charged for that, you know, and are prosecuted for it. But that was up for grabs in the Congress at the time. So I went up to do a piece on that. And that's when I first, you know, I was there for a couple of weeks and covered the Reagan administration for it. And that was the first time I got to visit the White House and be in the Brady briefing room. And that was the first day there. I met Sam Donaldson, Helen Thomas, and the President of the United States. And that was, you know, everybody's given Biden grief about tripping and falling.
Yeah.
And I talk about often that, you know, here I was like 24 years old. I was up in upper press trying to talk to Larry Speaks when the Secret Service, and I wasn't the only one. I think Helen was there and banging on the door. And if I did it today, they'd arrest me. But she banging on the door telling Larry Speaks to get his ass out here and talk to her. And about that time, Secret Service comes through and says, listen, you guys got to leave. The president's coming over here to talk to Larry. And so everybody turns to leave. I turn to leave, and I trip and fell over my own feet. And then, you know, I'm looking up, and there's Ronald Reagan standing over me going, well, young fella, you don't have to bow in front of me. That was my entry into D.C. So if they, you know, there was no sandbag involved, and I was 24. So if you want to gripe about, you know, Biden falling down, give me a break.
I know. I mean, my mother, it was so funny because she has a very similar story where she tripped over her own feet. And, you know, she was younger at the time. So, yeah, I mean, we've all done it. And it's like they either call him, they say that he has dementia, but then he outsmarts them at every turn. So they're all just idiots.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I don't think you find me disagreeing with that.
And we will be getting to the political questions in just a second, but you have to indulge me a little bit more. So let me ask you this. With your job, do you feel that your job is high stress?
No, I'm the one who applies the stress.
So, and then would you say, like, with your job, I know you write for Salon, so, but that's different than, do you also work for CNN still?
Well, I go on, whenever somebody asks me to go on a show, I'll go on a show, whether it's on Fox, CNN, or MSNBC, CBS. If somebody asks me and, you know, I'm free, I'll do it.
Do you have like a work week where you do the same thing every week, or is it always different for you?
There is a bit of dull routine to it, a bit of a routine to it. It's not dull, but I mean, depends on where I am in the country. You know, like a couple of weeks ago, I ended up being the pool reporter in LA for the VP. That was an eye opener. And, you know, and then I still write the weekly column. I try to come up with the ideas over the weekend. I'll craft it on a Monday or Tuesday, get it done by Wednesday, so it's publishable by Thursday. I try to put some thought into them and not, you know, and you know, you mentioned humor. I think humor is important for people to, you know, and we live in such a humorless world. People just are so, they're so serious all the time. You know, I feel like the Joker now, why he's so serious? But, you know, it's always, people are so damn full of themselves. You know, yeah. I'm right, you're wrong, and because I'm right, you're the devil. I'll go fuck yourself, excuse me. But that's, you know, at the end of the day, it's, if you can't take a little bit of humor, you know, yeah. It's like a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. Spoonful of humor helps everybody live together. And,
yeah.
And that's what you got to do. Even, you know, I mean, I just laugh so often at people who take themselves seriously. I don't get it.
Yeah. I know. And then there's the stupid factor, which I won't even get into. But yes, It's,
well, stupid people don't usually have a very good sense of humor.
They don't. No, that. And you know, it's funny because I certainly never thought this was going to be my life. I started off blogging, and it's funny because a lot of people told me you should be a writer, and I was never interested, although I did study journalism briefly in college, but I didn't go in that direction. But what I was able to do, what I caught it, like when I started blogging in 2012, and basically what got me in the door was an open letter to Rush Limbaugh from a liberal slut. And I used my humor. I used my sarcasm and humor. And that's, you know, it's not that I'm the greatest writer in the world or specific. I mean, I'm not really a journalist or anything like that, but I used to write political blogs. But I definitely felt like incorporating humor was so important because initially, starting out in my life, I wasn't political at all. My mother was always political, and she always watched the news, and she always voted, and she was always responsible and everything. You know, I was the 90s young woman who didn't give a shit because I was comfortable, and I could go to Planned Parenthood, and I could get birth control, and I didn't have to worry about anything. And so I really just wasn't paying attention, you know. And I completely lost my train of thought. But
I had a date like that once. That's okay.
I hate when that happens. Ultimately, though, I think, I know, I was getting into the humor, is that what I was able to do is, you know, I mean, even though I wasn't terribly political at that time, I was just starting out. I was political, but not hardcore. I just noticed that the humor, if you put that humor in, you pull in people who are otherwise not interested in politics. And that's so important because that's what got, it's kind of what, you know, I mean, I don't like Bill Maher anymore, but I used to enjoy his show because there was an element of humor to it. And so, yeah, it's extremely important. Like I said,
I don't like him anymore.
Why do I not like him anymore?
Yeah.
There's a number of reasons, but I think the number, and okay, let me just preface this by saying, I always thought he was kind of a dick. And but I agreed with a lot of what he said, and I thought he was smart. I didn't agree with everything, though. And the thing that really pushed me over the edge was when he told the Me Too movement not to go too far. I was so fucking, I mean, he had already pissed me off a couple of, you know, he was starting to, I guess he, sometimes he'll have a Republican on, which I don't care if he has a Republican, but if he lets them get away with a lie and doesn't call them out on the lie and lets them, you know, just spew their bullshit, that pisses me off. And then, so he said that. And then ever since then, it's gotten worse, where I just feel like he, you know, he said COVID is over when it wasn't over. It's still not over. But I mean, back when he said it, it was far from where it is now. There were just things about him that I decided that I don't want to listen to him anymore because I think he doesn't necessarily fight back against some of the lies in the way that I wish he would and the way that I think he used to.
He's trying very hard to go after both sides, but yeah, I think his greatest sin is he's just not funny.
Yeah.
That's I don't give a shit about the rest of it. I just watch him and go, boring.
Well, you know, the funny thing is I never watched Politically Incorrect, and I didn't like him. And I hate to say it, but I just didn't like his fucking face. I didn't like his face. I never did. And I wasn't political. But in 2002, I was invited to this A-list party in L.A., and I went by myself. So, and I was like, I think I was 33, and I looked great. You know, I was an actress at the time. I was in great shape. I looked amazing. And I went to this A-list party all by myself. And I saw him. And he walked right past me. And if it had been 2012, I would have tapped him on the shoulder. And I probably could have had a conversation with him. But I just thought, ugh.
Or
I
didn't. More.
But, you know, it's and the funny thing about this is, and I'll be really brief because this is my Hollywood spin story and I've told it before, but I watched him in 2012 and Alan Thicke was on. And I was like, oh, my God. And I saw Alan Thicke at that party, too. And Alan was checking me out. And so, but nothing, you know, we didn't even talk to him, but he was hardcore checking me out. So I got a hold of him through Facebook. And I was like, hey, you know, you and I wanted to go on Real Time. I saw him on Real Time. And I thought, because I was the I'm getting ahead of myself. I was the spokesperson for Rock the Slut Vote because of my, you know, open letter to Rush Limbaugh from a liberal slut. So I was with this organization, Rock the Slut Vote, and I wanted to get on real time before the 2012 election. So
Rock the Slut Vote.
Yeah. And I didn't start it. This other woman started it, and she asked me to be the spokesperson. So I said yes.
Okay.
And it was just because Rush Limbaugh called Sandra Flick a slut for like 3 days on his podcast. So
we're on the show. I just want to know how you rock the slut vote.
Well, we just didn't take any shit from
I'm
the patriarchy.
I'm open to hearing that, but go ahead.
So I said, I decided, okay, I want to get on real time. And I messaged Alan Thicke. And I said something like, you and I were at a party in 2002, we exchanged glances. So I was friendly. Like, we exchanged glances. We never spoke, blah, blah, blah. I told him I wanted to get a hold of the person who runs Real Time. So I got the name of the producer, and I messaged the producer, and I was like, hey, Alan Thicke recommended I get in touch with you, which he didn't recommend. And so I was actually considered for that show. But I was contacted by the woman who books it, and she asked me for all of my information, and I didn't get on. And instead, it was the show before the election, and the woman that they chose to be on the show was fucking Ann Coulter. I was so angry because it was like, okay, I didn't expect that it would be me, although I thought maybe we have a shot here. But Ann Coulter, thank God Obama won, but I was so pissed. I was really pissed.
On shows with her, she's nuts.
No, she is. Now, have you gone on Real Time?
No, I have not. I got invited once and wasn't able to do it, and I they didn't call me back.
Would you go now?
Oh yeah, sure. I'd go on. I don't have anything against going on and making fun of people, and I'm included. I would probably be on there once, and then, you know, it'd be like what Jim Morrison said when he sang on Ed Sullivan, a band lyric, and he says, you'll never be back on Ed Sullivan. And he goes, oh, I've already been on Ed Sullivan.
That's
who
awesome.
Gives a shit? You know, game over. Quarter.
Okay, I guess we can start getting into some political questions now. Even though I still could ask you, I could talk to you for another hour about just fun stuff, but I do.
Anything you want.
I know. It's my show, and I could do anything. Okay, well, you know what? Let me see something. Actually, before we get into politics, I will ask you, because he's so darn cute, about your eternally happy grandson. Oh, my God. You post his picture often, and he looks like your little mini-me. So I just want to know how old he is, and how often do you see him?
He is 3 years old. I get to see him more often when I'm out on the West Coast, because that's where both of my sons live. I'll see him every day. When I'm out here, where all three of my sons live. And, but yeah, he's very precocious. he some of the things he does remind me of me, but, the other day he just took off out of the house and went running down the street and scared the hell out of his dad. He had his friend, and he called, what I like about him is when he's out in public, he calls everybody friend. Hi, friend. And, you know,
so
at that age, you don't want to shake that out of them. It's nice that they see the world that way, and you want them to keep seeing the world that way. And that's always a challenge. But he's a good it makes me happy just to be around him.
Yeah. What's his name?
The eternally happy grandson.
But what's his real name? Or do you tell his real name?
Oh, Slevin. His real name is Slevin.
Slevin?
Not a name I would pick, but no, I'm not the dad or the mom, but that was from the movie, actually. Lucky Number Slevin is my son and his wife both liked that movie and liked that name, and so that's his name. Slevin Octavius. He'll probably be 35 before he grows into his name.
Wow, well, he's just so cute, and every time I see him, I mean, he does look like he's an eternally happy little kid, so.
He is usually very happy.
Aw.
But he's an only child right now, so he's, you know, I keep telling him they're going to spoil his ass rotten. Mm-hmm. They need to get him. I want to see another grandson or granddaughter. Not that there's any pressure.
Right.
All I keep hearing is, we're trying. I can try harder.
Aw. All right, now we have to go into the politics, which in a way I don't want to do, but in a way I have to, because I need to know your opinion about this. I'm going to start off with the whole Trump indictment situation and Jack Smith and all of that. So Andrew Weissman posted yesterday that he thought Trump would be indicted this week. Now, we know the grand jury's meeting, I don't know when, maybe today, and it appears to be that they're at the end of the investigation. Now, I'm not sure, I don't know if I'm remembering this correctly. Did you hear if they were bringing in another witness? Or do you know if they're just meeting?
I heard, as you just reported, that there would be, you know, later this week, perhaps, an indictment or some statement made. So we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, then that's what I was just basically going to say, because Weissman said he's pretty sure that it's going to happen this week. But like Ari Melber last night was saying, I don't know when. We can't really know when. And I'm going to kind of go with Ari on this, just because I feel like it's impossible to know what's happening. But I feel like we're going to see an indictment pretty soon, but it may not be this week. I mean, are you getting any kind of gut feeling on this?
I think that if there is an indictment to come, there'll be a statement. So either the statement saying we've decided not to indict will come soon, or the indictment will come soon. Mm-hmm. With what Donald Trump said yesterday on his social media accounts leads me to believe that he thinks he's going to be indicted.
Yeah.
So I am assuming that that's going to be coming sooner rather than later. But when is – look, grand juries are very – I've covered a lot of them. They're very tricky things. And anyone who would like to bet on when something would come from a grand jury, you know, I'll take the over under on the on a long shot at Belmont before I take that, because it's tough to gauge.
Yeah. And do you think, okay, so there's also the idea, I mean, there are a lot of people out there who are under the very wrong impression that if he's indicted or in jail, that he couldn't run. Well, first of all, I don't think he's going to be going to jail before the 2024 election. I could be wrong on that if he's ever sentenced to jail, but I doubt it.
There's no way in hell he'll be in jail before the 2024 election.
I don't see that happening. But obviously, people
doesn't make bail.
Right, exactly. but I mean, there's the idea that he's on trial during the 2024 election season, and there are people online who believe that that is going to hurt him, and maybe it will. What do you think? Do you think that's going to hurt him, or do you think it's going to matter, or even help him?
The people at this point that are so enamored of Donald Trump, while their numbers are probably smaller than in the 2020 election, are far more bound to him than anyone else. And so I would say that his numbers will continue to be the 28-30% range. If he stays in the race, he will get the nomination, because I've gone over that in the last few days. I can't believe the number of times I've gone on. Let's see. We've got Ron DeSantis, Mike Pence, Chris Christie, Nikki Haley, Tim Scott, Donald Trump, Asa Hutchinson, the former Arkansas governor, radio host Larry Elder, Jackie Gleason, and the CEO of Anti-Woke, Vivek Ramaswamy. So these are the and Ugly Kid Joe. So these are the guys that are running for the Republican nomination, and none of them can attract the voters that he can. Mm-hmm. So if he stays in this race, he will get the Republican nomination. You have to wonder why Ron DeSantis is in it, because he attracts, or tries to attract, the same voters that Donald Trump does. And so he has to be figuring, the only thing that makes sense from that perspective is that he believes that Donald Trump will not be in the race, and that he will And I don't think there's, you know, it. I don't think it's a natural conclusion to say that he would get Donald Trump's voters, but I'm sure that's what he thinks. Mm-hmm. So that's that is the only thing that makes sense to me as to why he's in the race. And so if Donald Trump drops out of the race, what would cause him to do it? Well, of course, it would be, you know, the simplest reason would be he would have legal problems. Mm-hmm. And he's given himself an out already. He has said that if, you know, he's running, but if a doctor comes along and says, oh, yeah, you know, your health is in trouble, you shouldn't run, that he will stop running. Right. So that would be what the excuse he would give for leaving the race. The real excuse would be, of course, that he sees the handwriting on the wall.
Yes.
But Donald Trump doesn't ever read, no. So that doesn't mean crap. I think he'll be in it, and I think he could win the GOP nomination. But at the same time, I have said this for a while, I don't think he'll be on the ballot in 2024. Whether the actuarial tables get him and he gacks out on a cheeseburger or he's under indictment and is so and has to fight all of those issues and doesn't want to, you know, stay in the race or for some other reason, I just don't foresee Donald Trump being in the race in 2024. That being said, I don't think Ron DeSantis is the natural heir. Mm-hmm. And I think the Republicans, the biggest thing that the Democrats should fear coming from the Republican Party is not Ron DeSantis and is not Donald Trump. The biggest thing I think the Democrats have to fear is understanding that the Republicans hate to lose, mm-hmm. and will do anything mm-hmm. to keep from losing. They tried it in the last election and they didn't get it to work, but mm-hmm. that doesn't mean that they won't try something again. And the something that they should be afraid of in the Democratic Party is a Liz Cheney ticket. Mm-hmm. If Liz Cheney, who could not right now get out of a Republican primary, somehow manages to get the GOP nomination, and Adam Kinzinger as a vice presidential candidate mm-hmm. would absolutely terrify, should be terrifying to most Democrats because she has crossover appeal. Mm-hmm. I don't find her appealing. Mm-hmm. She voted with Donald Trump 93% of the time, but all the polls show that she does have a crossover appeal with Democratic voters, and that would be a very tough ticket to beat mm-hmm. no matter who's on the Democratic side of the balance sheet. So that's my take on it in a nutshell, or not so much of a nutshell.
Okay, so how would it work if so let's say Donald gets the nomination and then, you know, as you said, he gacks out on a cheeseburger or whatever and he's not the nominee. So how would they figure out who the nominee would be? Let's just say
the Republican National Committee would then draft a nominee in all likelihood and then put it up to a vote. The Republicans, you know, for all that the blunder and bluster about how they're upset with the Democrats because, you know, Biden's not going to, you know, isn't going to debate, you know, other Democrats. Well, the Republicans have the rules written, and let's be honest, you don't have to have an election. The primary elections are nice things because they show who, you know, the majority of people support, but we used to pick candidates from the parties in back rooms mm-hmm. over a smoke and cheeseburgers and bourbon and come out and go, okay, we drafted so-and-so, and mm-hmm. then they'd have a floor debate. They've gotten rid of all that old party time politics and replaced it with the pomp and ceremony of, you know, primaries and caucuses, and none of that used to be how they picked. You know, they would draft them on two or three, you'd take two or three ballots of voting among the delegates mm-hmm. at the convention to pick a candidate. And they don't do that anymore. It's perfunctory. The vote that they have on the floor is just to basically to, you know, seal the approval of the done deal done by the Democrat, by the primaries and the caucuses. But so if one of their, if the nominee were to suddenly not be on the ticket for health reasons or any other reason, then what would happen is the committee would pick who it, and then they would vote on it, the committee members,
right,
in all likelihood. So that's it in a nutshell there.
So, okay, I just want to know specifically, you were promoting Just Ask the Question podcast, and you said Donald Trump is going down, DeSantis will make you throw up, and another indictment for Trump is probably coming up. Okay, so why will DeSantis make us throw up?
Have you ever seen the guy?
Mr. Pudding Fingers? I know, I was just wondering if there was any specific thing.
He has all the appeal of roadkill.
I know, he does.
He is not going to get the Republican nomination. He just won't.
Yeah.
And there are, the Republicans don't like him. And Chris Sununu backing out of it because, Chris Sununu actually has some common sense.
Yeah.
Is indicative of the fact that those who still have any sense in the Republican Party are letting, the dissent, the maggots eat their own. And at the end of the day, they want to swoop in and, and save the day. But I don't see that there's any day to be saved. I think the Republican Party, as we've known it, is done. The biggest fear that we should have as voters is that these gerrymandered districts continue to allow minority candidates choose their voters instead of the voters choosing their representatives. That's a huge problem, and we have to clean that up.
Yeah. All right. So then it's not the same note, but it's kind of as far at least what the Democrats have to worry about. So we've got the no labels ticket with possible Joe Manchin. We've got Marianne Williamson running and Cornel West. Now, it's not that I think any of these people are going to be president, but how damaging do you think they can be to the Democratic Party in 2024?
Depends on how much funding they get and how much we listen to them. I don't see them as any type of serious threat. I don't think that any of them can garner, very many votes. But at the same time, it's such a close... If it is a repeat of the last election, there are only 6 or 8 states that really matter. And those are 6 or 8 states. It's, just a minimal number of votes per precinct that matter. And so 1 or 2 votes going to a third party candidate could matter. It's just way too early to tell.
Yeah.
And anyone who wants to handicap this race right now, I just don't see how you do it. And, and maybe I'm not very good at doing it, but I just don't see that it can happen when you don't really know who the candidates are and what's going to happen before the conventions. After the conventions and we picked running mates and presidential nominees, okay, then I'll talk then.
Right.
Or I'll prognosticate then. And, those are people, and most prognosticators got it wrong in the last election.
True.
Hillary was going to win.
Yeah.
And she just, that didn't happen. So handicapping is particularly when you've got someone as volatile as Donald Trump in the race is just damn difficult to do. And it's really hard to do there. It's like, trying to read sifting sand right now. You just can't do it. It's so anyone who says they can is just a liar.
Yeah. I agree.
Or a fool or both.
Yes. Okay, my last question here. I believe yesterday Gavin Newsom, he's bringing kidnapping charges against Ron DeSantis for his migrant stint.
That's the rumor. That's hilarious.
Right. So, okay, let's just go with it and say he does it. My question to you is, do you think this will inspire Democrats to be a little bit more creative and aggressive when fighting for democracy? And then the bigger question is, do you see Democrats getting better? I'm going to maintain that voters are part of this deal too, that we have our part to play, but that we've got leaders, whether they're in the party or they're, outside groups or whatever, messaging groups. Do you see that messaging is getting more aggressive or more creative or more effective?
I maintain that in this country we have two political parties. One has two major political parties. One has no heart and one has no head. And I don't see either one of them growing the appendage they need. The Democrats piss me off all the time because it's like, you know, well, we said it once. Well, God, you watched Donald Trump for 4 years drive a narrative based on no facts.
Right.
You actually have some facts at your disposal, and you will not drive the narrative. You let the Republicans frame the narrative every single time. Mm-hmm. You let them say that liberalism is a bad thing. You let them say that, you know, Donald Trump promised us for freaking 4 years infrastructure reform. It's infrastructure week here at the White House. I heard that every damn Monday for 4 years, and they did squat. Biden has gotten in, and look, I've traveled across this country three times back and forth in the last year and a half, and I can tell you with my own eyes that we are finally upgrading infrastructure. Mm-hmm. If you've been on an interstate anywhere and had to sit and wait for a while, you get it. Mm-hmm. They're upgrading railroad crossings. They're upgrading water. All these things that are good for rural America, by the way, and would help drive some of those red states towards the blue. And you can't find any Democrat running on the things. There are two issues that if I were a Democrat right now, I would be going, listen, women have the right to choose. 80% of the people on the planet in the United States agree with that sentiment. I'd be driving that narrative. And I would be driving the narrative that, you know, the Republicans promised we delivered, we delivered, we delivered. Now, Biden says that on occasion. But the difference is during the Trump administration, it wasn't just the president who shot his mouth off whenever he wanted, for sure. But you had, you know, you had people on the South Lawn. You had people on the North Lawn. You had them on the TV shows. You had them, you know, Kellyanne Conway every day driving the false narrative going on any show she could. There were people, Mike Flynn, you know, all of them were preaching the lies, and people bought them. They bought into it. This guy's got the truth behind him. And you've got – I've actually seen Republicans – running on the infrastructure bill that they voted against as if they're the champions of it. And for the love of God, open your mouth up. It's not enough to say it once. You got to keep saying it. 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 But they let the Republicans, you know, frame the narrative. For example, George Santos. Now, you can point and say, the press didn't do a good job. One newspaper uncovered his lies and his BS before that, and we didn't run with it, and we should have. However, the Democrat who ran against him, where the hell was he? Why wasn't he standing out there every day on the street corner going, liar, 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 bullshit, lie, lie. That would have been my whole case for getting, and I don't look at them as leaders either. I look at them as employees. They work for me. They're the tax my tax dollars pay for them. So damn it, you are responsible for to answer the questions of your constituents. And they don't do it. And we don't hold them accountable in the press. And the Democrats don't do what they need to do in order to get their word out there. Very frustrating all the way around.
Yeah, it is very frustrating. I will say, and I agree with you 100%, but at least I do think we're seeing a little bit more fight in them. I mean, I you know, there's certain Democrats that are really good at it. You know, Jamie Raskin is pretty good at it, and so is...
Well, I've known Jamie for 20 years, and he's never shied away from a fight.
Yeah.
I mean, he was, back when he was in the State House in Annapolis, he was that way, but... And he, you know, and God, by the way, I was when we had debates among the nine candidates in his first run for that office, I moderated those debates.
Wow.
And he was, he was like Donald Trump in one regard, and that is he had a solid base of people who supported him. Kathleen Matthews was favored to win that race. And then David Trone jumped in at the last minute, and those two split the votes, and the base that supported Jamie, they kept with Jamie, and therefore he won the race. And thank God he did, because Kathleen and David would not have, as you know, they're as whatever they are, they would not have been as good on the Constitution and on those and in the impeachment and the January 6th committee hearings as Jamie Raskin was.
Yeah.
And so, yes, he's always been that way. I'm talking about a central, the strategy I'm talking about comes from the White House.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the White House strategy for communication is baffling to me because it's so ineffective.
You're right. Yeah, I know. That's really, it's like, ugh. It's disappointing and it's extremely frustrating because you constantly see, I mean, just me as a regular person on the internet or whatever, and constantly in the news, I'm always seeing I don't know what else to call them, the bad people. The bad people keep winning. I mean, yes, we have wins, and obviously Biden won and all that stuff, but bad ideas and bad people keep getting ahead because, like you said, they repeat. And, you know, when I started doing my thing, like social media work online, what I realized very quickly, like when I was an author and I wanted people to read my book, I realized what you have to do is spell it out. Click here. If you don't say click here, they'll be like, I don't know how to get your book, even though the URL is right there. It's like people need to be told how to do certain things. And I wish that the Democrats would realize that it does need to be spelled out. It's not that people are stupid. It's just that people are busy. Sometimes they're stupid, but they're busy or they're not paying a lot of attention and they just need, show me what to do and I'll do it. And I think the Democrats could do a little more with that.
Yeah, I think that qualifies as stupid, but okay. Sure. I'll give you the benefit of the doubt, but no. In all sincerity, I think the big problem is that you are overwhelmed with information.
Yeah, definitely.
And what gets through in life is repetition.
Yes.
And you have to, you know, that's why it's very, that's one thing that Donald Trump excels at, since he's not that bright himself. If you give him three words to say, make America great again, that guy, I'm going to win bigly, make America great again. If you do that, then, you know, he can do it and people hear it and they respond to it. And the Democrats are not that, there's more nuance to them than that. But it's frustrating to me to listen, to go out and interview, you know, and representatives and people running for government knowing that they're lying, and I call them into question on their lies, but they know they can get away with those lies because people will believe them, and instead the people will get upset because I'll ask them about their lies.
Mm-hmm.
When basically they should be upset because these people are lying to them,
right,
taking advantage of them. And at the same time, it's like the wise man said, it's easier to fool people than to convince them that they've been fooled.
So true. Oh, it just makes me think of certain MAGA family members. So
yeah, we all have.
Yes. Oh, my God. Well, you know, I just got to say, I absolutely love talking to you. I love when you're on the show. And the next time you come back, I'll probably come up with some more questions just about your life, because that was really fun and I didn't get to all of them, but I just want to say thank you so much.
Well, what you got in your pocket there, kid?
let me look through. Okay, well, this is just a silly one. Some of your favorite movies?
Plan 9 from Outer Space, Bitch Mountain. I don't know. You know, I did see a movie lately that I loved, and I hadn't had a movie experience like it in a while, and it was great. I took my kids to it. We went to see The Machine with Burt Kreischer and Mark Hamill from Star Wars playing his dad, and I laughed. That was the best movie experience I've had laughing in a while. So
wow.
I love that comedy. But, you know, Blazing Saddles I love, Jaws I love, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Mm-hmm. I have to see that.
To Kill a Mockingbird. I don't know if I have a favorite. And 2001 A Space Odyssey, just because it's trippy.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. My sister, she's 18 years younger than I am. And she came out to visit me in California one year. I think she was probably about 12. And I kept using the word trippy. And she's like, what does trippy mean? So every time I hear that word.
Let me take you back to Woodstock, baby. You know, here's the thing about LSD. I was a young kid in college, and you get warnings, right? First of all, cocaine, I was never attracted to cocaine because it was like $100 and, 30 minutes straight up and then, straight down. I'm going, that's not a wise application of my limited funding. So, I guess it's the rich man's drug, because I was in college. And then the other one, was that, all right, weed was fine. It could take you for a while. But they would say, all right, LSD. You take a tab of LSD. You got to be careful because if you take a tab of LSD, you're going to be gone for about 10 hours, and then 20 years from now, you're going to be walking down the street, and you're going to be tripping again. You'll have a flashback. And I'm going, well, that's like a two-for-one deal. All right, I'm a good capitalist. I'm in. And so here has been, more than 20 years. I've never had my flashback. I think it was a false advertisement, and I can't find my dealer to sue his ass in court.
Well, let me ask you this. Did you enjoy it?
I don't remember. No, yes, I did.
How old were you?
There was a saying that Paul McCartney had that I liked about LSD. He goes, it's like taking an aspirin without having a headache. And so at the end of the day, when it was all said and done, it was a lot of fun. I mean, honestly, I remember I was in a speech class in college.
Okay.
And I dropped a couple of hits of Purple Windowpane. And I went to my speech class in lab. So it was the big part of the class where, on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, we gave presentations in this theater. So there'd be like 500 people, and you'd have to make your speech. I was scheduled to go on Friday and not on the Wednesday. But you're supposed to be ready to go at any point in time, and I didn't figure I was going to have to go. But sure enough, the two people that were supposed to go that day didn't. So I'm tripping balls, and they put me up there to make my speech. To this day, I cannot tell you what it is that I said. I cannot tell you what the subject matter was, but I do remember getting a standing ovation and an A-plus on the speech.
Wow. I wish somebody would have recorded that. That's so funny.
I was like, what did I say? And at one point, I remember looking out over the audience, and they looked like bleeding sheep. They were all bleeding. And I was like, all right.
So that didn't freak you out?
No, I enjoyed the hell out of it.
Now, did you ever try mushrooms?
Yes.
Did you like them?
Yes, I did.
I wound up in Hollywood Presbyterian the night that I tried mushrooms.
Oh my goodness.
No, yeah, it was bad.
In fact, I gave them to my dad when he had cancer. I was trying. I had all kinds of suggestions how to get my dad's appetite back. He had been diagnosed with lung cancer, and they gave him like 6 weeks to live, and he took 2 years. And I went down and pulled him out of a hospital at one point in time. I said, you're moving in with me. So I sold off all his shit. He was living in Texas and moved him up with me to Gaithersburg. And we started every day walking, and we would measure our walks and, the mailboxes by the side of the road. So he started out 4 or 5 mailboxes, and he'd have to go back home. Mm-hmm. And he had lost a lot of weight. And after a month, I had him up to almost 3 miles a day. We were walking.
Wow.
And I got his appetite up by getting him high.
Mm-hmm.
But the pain was tough on him. Mm-hmm. At one point in time, in fact, I went to see him in San Antonio, and the doctor said, listen, the cancer is everywhere in his body except his heart and his brain. We don't think he has much time left. And I said, have you told him? And he goes, no. I said, well, don't you think you should? And he said, well, will you go with me? And I'm going, brave doctor. Yeah, sure, fine, all right. So we walk in. He tells, Mr. Karam, the cancer is here, there, everywhere, and we don't think you have much time left. And my dad, who looked like a skeleton, sat bolt upright in bed and said, fuck you. And the doctor said, what does that mean? I go, I'm betting on the guy that says fuck you. So I packed everything up. I moved him up there. And to get rid of the pain, there was a doctor who said, you didn't hear me say this, but opioids aren't the best because they'll make him constipated and mm-hmm. provide other problems. He goes, but get him some hallucinogens. And I'm going, cool, I'm just the guy for that. So, hey, not a problem. So, I knew a guy who knew a guy who had a cousin who knew a guy. And I got him some, mushrooms. And that helped him out a lot. I got to tell you, it killed the pain more than anything else.
Interesting. Now, did he have, was he tripping? He must
have
been tripping.
Oh, yeah, he was tripping balls.
Did he like it?
He loved it.
Wow.
But, it's the environment.
Yeah, it is.
One thing to learn about hallucinogens is that you have to make the environment comfortable mm-hmm. and warm and inviting.
Mm-hmm.
And if it isn't, then you can create a bad trip quicker than anything else.
Yeah, and then you wind up in the hospital.
Sounds like you found out.
Yeah. I mean, because I was a teenager, and I just figured, mushrooms are from the earth, and what could be wrong with that? I was afraid of LSD. So I just thought, mushrooms are the natural thing. And my girlfriends had all had them. And it was the beginning of my senior year. And we were going to go up to the Griffith Park Observatory, which at the time I was living in Torrance. So the Griffith Park Observatory was pretty an hour away. And I won't go into the whole story because I've told it here before, but the funny parts. So first what we do is we're driving around Torrance all day, and we had told everybody at my school, laser show, Led Zeppelin laser show at the, at the observatory. So we're telling everyone to go. And then that Saturday, we're just driving around in my friend's 57 Chevy, and we meet up with these young guys that my friends knew, I didn't. They were the ones who had the mushrooms, but we had been drinking Bartles and James. I don't even remember if I ate anything. So I only had Bartles and James in my stomach. And then we get to the observatory and we take a little circle in your palm amount of mushrooms. I didn't chew them up very well because they tasted nasty. And I wound up, passing out, and it was so awful. The ambulance had to come, and they had to carry, they put me on a stretcher because I couldn't walk. And I was so embarrassed, so I put the sheet over my head, and my friend's yelling to everybody, "She's not dead, she's just embarrassed." and so my mother...
So you had Bartles and James in you. Who was better, Bartles or James?
Well, I know, this is so gross, but when I got into the, what's it called? I can't think of the
triage.
Ambulance. When I got into the ambulance, I told the guy, "What are they going to do?" He's like, "Well, they're probably going to give you some charcoal and make you throw up." And I'm like, "Give it to me now." And he's like, "No, you could just wait till you get to the hospital." And I said, "If you don't give it to me now, I'm going to stick my finger down my throat and do it myself." So he did. And when I got sick, it was just Bartles and James and mushroom. That's all that came up. But it was funny because, my mother, who's very cool, she is a very cool mother. She always told me, if you're going to do something like mushrooms, please do them at home. She didn't want me to do them, but it's like you said, she understood the environment. She had a bad trip on acid when she was younger. So she said, make sure that you're in a safe place. And of course, I didn't listen to her. So I told the paramedic and the people at the observatory, call my mother. And eventually, when they're going to wheel me off, I said, "Did you call my mother?" And they're like, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, can I call her?" So no one had called her. And she answers the phone, and she was fucking watching Falcon and the Snowman. And I'm like, "Mom, has anyone called you?" "No." And it was like her one day off. She was working in the car business, and it was one day off the next day. And so I'm like, "Has anyone called you?" "No." And I'm like, "Oh, you're going to be really pissed." "Well, what's wrong?" I'm like, "You're going to be really angry." She goes, "Just spit it out." "I'm on shrooms. Here's the paramedic." And then the paramedic told her where to go. And then she had to come pick me up. And it was it was not a fun situation for me. And I never tried hallucinogens after that. So that was my experience with mushrooms. And
those were my favorite.
That's what I hear.
The thing that you said about your mom, that was one of the things, that kept me from being like a lot of kids that I grew up with. My dad and my mom both were like, "Listen, you're a teen.
Mm-hmm.
We know you're going to drink. Don't pretend you're not. You're going to try some things. Don't try to hide it from us. Just don't drink and drive. Don't take anything and drive, and do it here in a safe environment.
Yeah.
And we won't care.
Right.
And so I never felt the need.
Yes.
I call it the cookie jar syndrome. If you tell a kid you anywhere in the kitchen but the cookie jar, where's the first fucking place you're going to go? So, you know, they said, oh, there must be something great in the cookie jar. I'm going there. But, you know, they told me that the cookie jar was fine. So I was like, eh, I'll try the cookie jar if I want. But it doesn't seem like it's that big of a deal. So I never drank to excess. I've never blacked out. Wow. I've never done anything like that because I just never felt the need to do it, or I felt like it was anything that was a worthy experience because my parents. And I that had a lot to do with, you know, I know plenty of people that are journalists that are alcoholics.
Yeah.
And I'm not one of them. And, you know, I don't do much of anything anymore because I just don't feel the need to.
Yeah.
And thank God that my parents taught me the way they did, because it's helped me keep in a better physical shape than some of my friends who are, you know, not in that good of shape.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. I always said it's like my mother basically gave me nothing to rebel against. In fact, when it came time when I was 15, I fought with her so hard, and she still brings this up to that day. Like, if I want to get my way and I finally get it, I'm like, I got my way. She's like, I know you, Kimberly. I know how you are. Because I was arguing for a 2 o'clock curfew. And I mean, we just went round and round and round, and I wore her down. And I think I got her to a 1 o'clock curfew. And as it turns out, you know, I mean, I didn't have a car. All my friends did, and they had to be home by 12. So I was always home before 12. But I won the debate.
Sure, you got a 2 o'clock curfew. Go ahead. my dad was infamous. He had – my mom and dad were divorced by this time. And when my sisters were dating, and my dad was just so good at intimidation. And he would, I remember one time he go, all right, where are you guys going tonight? I mean, he's over at the house every time my sister would go out on a date, and he didn't live there. My mom was fine with it because she didn't want to deal with that
right.
shit. So dad's there, and he goes, all right, so where are you going? We're going out for a dinner and a movie. What time are you going to have her home? Well, her curfew's at midnight. Yeah, so what time are you going to have her home? 11:30 be okay? Good lad. Okay, yeah, good job. So then I remember one time this kid came rolling in like 5 minutes past curfew with my sister. My dad is sitting on the front porch of the house in a rocking chair with a shotgun that's not loaded.
Right.
But he racks the shotgun. You brought her home late, boy. And my sister's jumping out of the car going, Daddy, he doesn't understand Lebanese humor. Don't hurt him. And the guy's like, ah! He took off, never to be seen again.
Wow. Oh my God, that's so freaking funny. Oh my God. It I think you're so right about the, when you just tell a kid, the cookie jar theory is perfect. It's so true, because that's exactly what you want to do. And I just, like, when I was a kid, I feel really fortunate because my mother, while she was not the traditional kind of parent, in that my parents were also divorced, and there were a lot of times where, you know, when she was in the car business, she worked bell to bell, which means, you know, 9 to 9. I was on my own a lot. And, but she always,
we were latchkey kids before it was cool to be a latchkey.
Exactly.
Kid.
We totally were. And I mean, we freaking invented it, our generation, because it was our parents that were getting divorced at like high rates. Yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, and I felt that because I had that experience of my mother basically just having to trust me. Sometimes it worked against both of us because I think she put a little too much faith in me. But eventually, I mean, I was a good kid, basically.
Right. So what the hell?
Exactly.
I mean, so what year were your parents divorced?
Well, I think it was 71. Let me take that back. They split up when I was 3. And then I don't know when the divorce came. It was several years later.
That's the year my mom and dad got divorced, 1971. I was going on 11. None of my brothers or sisters who were much younger remember them together. I remember them together. And when dad was – see, they got married too young.
Mm-hmm. So did mine.
And they grew up together. They grew apart.
Mm-hmm.
And they both never found better mates than their original pairing, those two together. And so when Pop is dying of cancer, I remember my mom, she's calling him up. He's in hospice. Tell Jim I love him. Dad, mom wants to talk to you. She says she loves you. And he goes, the ship sailed on that 20 years. Dad, just say, I love you too, Pat. I love you too. And so I'm going, all right, good. And then, you know, the thing about it was, it was during that era, you know, like a woman needs a man, like a fish needs a bicycle.
Yeah.
And there was, you know, men were fighting against their traditional roles, not wanting women to be in the workplace. It was a time of we look at today as a time of strife, but come on, when I grew up in the 60s and the early 70s, that was when the civil rights movement was new. And there was, you know, plus we had Tet, we had, you know, the Vietnam War, we had riots at the Democratic National Convention, Bobby got shot, Martin Luther King got shot, riots in major cities every day. It was horrible. But we didn't have social media,
right,
which is the difference.
Yes.
But we did have all those things that were going on, and I just think in my case, I know it overwhelmed my parents. They just didn't know how to deal with it. And, you know, my mom was a very strong woman, very strong-willed woman, and she was on, you know, did a morning show on local television.
Wow.
She was an auction manager for the public television station. She broke the glass ceiling many times. And she was always one of my biggest, I mean, when I was growing up, you know, you're a mama's boy. I go, what's wrong with that? I love my mom. What the fuck?
Right.
You know, I mean, my dad was out of my life for 10 years.
Wow.
And didn't see him. But that era, we look at it today, and everybody thinks that everything that we're going through today is so unique. And I'm just going, it seems like I've been here before.
Yeah. Yes. And you know what's funny? I just learned this. My mother told me today, I guess Rachel Maddow is coming out with a new show, Deja News, for that exact reason, that we've gone through all of this before. And you're right that the difference is we didn't have social media then, but this, we're not really going through anything new.
Yeah, it's same as it ever was.
Yeah, pretty much.
And that's, you know, and having lived through it once, and I listened, my wife and I one day were walking in the mall of all places, and there's this kid walking along with a marijuana hat, a marijuana t-shirt. He's talking about the weed. He's a street team guy who works for one of the weed places out in L.A. And, you know, the weed, first of all, I love the fact that you ride in the store today and it's like drive through for weed.
Right. I know.
When I was a kid, you know, it was a baggie and, you know, four fingers deep and $20, and you did it on the side. And, you know, it was sketchy and you didn't know. And this is all on the up and up. You walk in, it's like a 7-Eleven of weed. And, oh, hey. I'm walking along and I just laughed. I mean, it laughed, and the kid saw me laugh. He goes, "What's the matter, Pops?"
Not a thing.
And he goes, "Well, you know, the problem with your generation is you just don't understand the weed, man. You don't understand the weed." And I looked at him and said, "Son, what you don't understand is my generation invented it."
You know.
I'm fine with a weed. In fact, if you did weed every day for the rest of your life, you wouldn't catch up with me. So get out of here.
Oh my God, that's so funny. Wow, they called you Pops. I mean, what is this, 1950?
Pops. Oh, dude.
That's funny.
Get me started. I'll break my foot off in your ass, goddammit. That was my dad's favorite saying. Don't make me break my foot off in your ass. Dad, how would you do that specifically?
How would that work?
I'm curious. I don't want it to happen, but man, there would be a lot of force there. And why my ass? Are you particularly enamored of my ass? Are you a Catholic priest?
Oh my God. Well, I know in Maryland in July it goes full on recreational. It's funny because Bob and I moved we were in Northern California for a while and we moved here. His parents are also in, you know, Virginia. My parents are here. But California had just gone recreational and we left. And so now Maryland is going recreational. So I guess that's
it should happen right down the street from me. I've already scoped it out.
There, I mean, it should just, everybody should do it now. There's so much revenue there's so much good to be. You
know, I go back to the comedian Bill Hicks.
Yes, who I love.
Something that I think is so true. He said, not only did he think that marijuana should be legal, he thought it should be mandatory. And I think it would solve a lot of world's ills if some of these uptight assholes
would just
got high and laid. And I think we'd all be better off for it.
Yes.
And, you know, I worked as a bouncer in college briefly at a bar, and I broke up a lot of fights among drunks.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I remember one drunk one night got so angry at another guy, he ripped his they were brawling out in the parking lot. One of them had a nipple ring on, and the guy ripped the nipple ring off and took the nipple with him.
Oh my God.
And I mean, drunks are nasty.
I know they
violent
are.
Violent people. Yeah. But you know, I never broke up a fight between two stoners. And stoners, when they get in a fight, it's like, dude, you stole the last Twinkie. Oh, fuck. I got a brownie. Cool. That's it. That's what they do. So, you know, there'd be fewer wars. Just imagine if everybody had to get stoned before they went to war.
Everybody. Exactly. Well, and you know, I told this before, but I think it's worth mentioning because I'm going to go ahead and guess that you do not watch Real Housewives of New Jersey. And I do.
That's true. I don't.
Although men do watch these shows. And I have found out.
Hell, they do.
Yeah,
I'm
it's
just
like
not one of them.
Yeah, and it's like neither is Bob. He just avoids the whole living area when I'm watching it, which for good reason. But I enjoy it for the reasons that I enjoy it. But so you know, part of that show, regardless if it's New Jersey or LA or wherever, alcohol is involved and fighting is always that is one of the big draws, right? Is where everybody's yelling and screaming at each other. So here's this thing happened a couple of weeks ago, and my mind was blown. Now, this is the New Jersey crowd, and so they're pretty much like the Sopranos. I mean, they're so close to the Sopranos, it's unbelievable. And there's this one guy who just looks like the Italian Jersey dude. He's all built and muscular. He's very, 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 you know, macho type. And so it you know, he comes out with this whole thing about, hey, I'm working for, basically he's working for a marijuana industry. I don't know exactly what he's doing. But he's a stoner and he's getting stoned all the time. And so there's this one night where all the husbands get together and all the wives get together. All the wives are drinking and all the husbands are smoking pot. And seriously, it was such a difference. The women are all screaming at each other and being nasty and horrible. And the men were just having a grand old time and laughing and eating. It was like, well, there you go.
That's what pot does.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, these it's funny to see this, you know, kind of macho, tough Italian guy just letting it all, you know, be loose and having fun. And it's exactly, send everybody to war, get everyone high, send them to war, and we'll have a much better outcome. I totally agree. Yeah,
that's right. What do you mean go to war, dude? Wait,
I take a nap first?
Oh, fuck that. Yeah, me too, man.
Well,
hey, aren't you my enemy? No, I brought the brownies. Oh, dude, great, yay!
Let's have brownies. Make brownies, yeah. Not war. Well, and you could also make pot brownies. So there you go. You could have like that double
edibles
whammy.
Edibles are the best.
Yeah. No, not for me though. I can't handle those.
Edibles I don't like to smoke anything anymore. But you know, I'll take, you know, maybe a cigar because I don't inhale it. Oh, you sit back. But if you're gonna ingest anything, just take, you know. Edibles.
Well, I've tried the edibles and I'm so sensitive that it's like I took a sleeping pill, because whenever I take a sleeping pill, I wake up completely groggy and it just makes me too tired. I'm too lethargic and too tired.
Don't do that. It's the, you want to do the sativa. You don't want to do the other.
Right. Right. The indica, which the way you remember it is in the couch. That's the way they taught me.
Indica put you in the couch.
All right. Well, I should let you go, cause we've been on for like an hour and a half now. So I told you 40 to 60 minutes, and we're just, you know, and we're going to have, you know, we talked about this off mic, but it would be awesome if you and your wife and Bob and I ever get together for dinner. We live close to each other. I think that would be so much fun, and we could just carry on this conversation.
Yeah, let's do it.
Awesome. All right. Well, before I let you go,
see the band in October.
Absolutely. And before I let you go, though, tell everybody where to find you.
The name of the podcast is Just Ask the Question, wherever fine podcasts are sold. You can also pick up the book. It's called Free the Press. And I write a weekly column for Salon.com. And on Thursdays, this Thursday, talking about subtlety in government. and, of course, variety of appearances on television whenever somebody goes, we really need that obnoxious asshole on TV. Get him back. that's it in a nutshell. It's at Brian Karam for all those social media applications.
Yes, and I'm also at Author Kimberly on Twitter and Kimberly Johnson on Spoutable. L-E-Y. Thank you, Brian. It's always awesome talking to you.
It's always fun.
You take care.